Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we have a fantasy novelist with us today on Writers' Voices. Charlie N. Holmberg is a Wall Street Journal and American Charts best-selling author of fantasy and romance fiction. She's published in over 20 languages, has been a finalist for a Rita Award and multiple Whitney Awards, and won the 2020 Whitney for Novel of the Year for Adult Fiction. Born in Salt Lake City, Charlie was raised a Trekkie, alongside three sisters who also have boy names. She is a BYU alumna, plays the ukulele, and owns too many pairs of glasses. Currently lives with her family in Utah. And the book that we're talking about today is Star Mother. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Charlie.
Thank you, but
I don't know about you. I've worn glasses since the third grade, okay?
I'm since eighth grade. Eighth grade is when I started.
So since the third grade. And I remember when I first decided I was going to buy two pairs of glasses in this prescription instead of one, it was like, I don't know, it was like a revelation that you could actually do that.
Right? I totally get it.
So how did you decide that glasses were actually more than just utilitarian? They could be a fashion accessory.
Honestly, I don't even know. It's a fun thing. Like, if you have to wear them, because me and contacts don't really get along. So if you have to wear them, it's nice to be able to accessorize them and get some personality with them and stuff. So.
Well, okay. So anyway, back to Star Mother. This is how many books have you published now?
This is my 15th.
15th. And they're in the areas of fantasy and romance. Did you start in one and go to the other, or do you go back and forth? How does that work?
Well, they're all shoved together. I have only one of my published books does not have a kissing scene in it. So they're either fantasy with romance or they're romantic fantasy.
Okay.
They go hand in hand.
And when did you first publish?
My debut novel came out in 2014.
Okay. So 15 in 7 years?
Yeah, it's about 2 a year.
Wow. Did you always know you wanted to be a writer? And I'm sure you've been asked that many times.
Yeah, I decided I did when I was 13. So pretty early on, yeah, I decided I wanted to be a writer. I watched this anime called Escaflowne, and I really loved the story, and I wanted to be a storyteller, and writing's just the medium that I ended up with.
And you said you grew up a Trekkie.
Yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know what that means you watched Star Trek.
Yes.
The original Star Trek?
Oh, I grew up on Next Gen. I tried to watch the original when I was in college, and it's not for me.
Okay. Yeah, it is different. It is true. But, you know, I'm talking to you from Iowa, and Captain Kirk was supposedly born in Riverside, Iowa, which is just up the road a little ways. So, you know, right. I do have some fondness for the original.
I did a state report on Iowa in elementary school.
And what did you learn about Iowa?
I don't remember. I just remember having to really work on how to pronounce Des Moines.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So tell us a little bit about Star Mother and what the premise of this book is.
So the idea behind Star Mother is it has its own god folklore. And stars are godlings, and they are the batteries of the universe, but they can only be born from the sun god and a mortal mother. And the mortal mother always perishes in the act. And so this story follows Saris Wended. I can say my own character's name, Wenden. And she volunteers to become a star mother, but she doesn't die. And so it's like a whole thing, like, why didn't she die? And when she's returned back home, she's 700 years in the future. And so everybody she knew is gone. And so it's a journey of her trying to find her sister's descendants and a journey of motherhood and a lot of secret things.
Now,
like, I'm so good at pitching.
I have to admit that I wasn't familiar with your work before Star Mother, but when I started reading it, I got into it really fast. But
Thanks.
because of your name, I thought it was written by a man, and I'm like, why is a man writing this about? Because it's so much about like giving birth and things that were. I'm like, well, that's. I mean, men can write women characters, but boy, this guy really seems to know what he's talking about.
Yes, I've been told I write women well. No, you're not the first one. A lot of people think I'm a man.
But it should have been obvious, really, because Charlie can obviously be a girl's name, you know, is.
It's very popular with young girls now. Like, I feel a lot of girls who are 7 and younger have the name Charlie. Sorry, my dog is at my door whining and
Poor baby.
wondering like why I'm like muting myself and yelling. I'm like, go away.
Are each of your books standalone?
No, some of
No.
them are and some of them aren't.
Okay.
So I have a couple series. So I have the Paper Magician series, which is 4 books, but one of them does stand by itself. And then I have the Spellbreaker duology that came out last year. And I have the Numina series, which came out a few years ago, and that was 3 books. And Star Mother is technically a duology, but they're companion novels, and so they can be read separately. And
And
then I have a smattering of standalones as well.
okay, so what's the related book with Star Mother?
It's called Star Father, and it comes out in March.
Oh, interesting. So did you, when you're writing books like this that are a duology, do you plan that from the very beginning?
For this one, I did not. For Spellbreaker, I did. For Star Mother, it was going to be a single volume. But as I was writing it and getting towards the end, I realized that there was another story that needed to be told for like a true happy ending for all the characters. And that's when I thought I have to write another book. And so I wrote Star Father.
When you're writing these books, are all of them sort of like alternate worlds kind of thing, you know?
A lot of them are. So I write either historical fantasy or I write high fantasy. So Star Mother is high fantasy, so it's otherworld. But I have a few, like my Paper Magician series, my Spellbreaker series, those are all historical.
Now, Star Mother, it's otherworld, but it's an Earth. It's Earth.
Earth-like, yes.
Yeah. And the gods, the god mythology in it has some relationship to Greek mythology. Were
No,
you
not.
none? You don't think so? I, you
Not on
know,
purpose.
okay. Well, the sun being a god, you know, is there's
Yeah,
some,
it's all it's
yeah.
celestial. A lot of celestial, all the celestial bodies are gods in some way. So the earth is a goddess, and the sun's a
Yeah.
god, the moon's a goddess.
Okay. And were you a fan of, I mean, do you know a lot about Greek mythology, Roman mythology, things like?
I know a good chunk. Like I know all the like really standard ones. So like the Cupid story, I know about obviously Hades and Persephone because I read a lot of retellings of those ones. So like I know all the general ones because I read them as a kid.
Okay.
You know, I was Medusa for Halloween in 3rd grade.
Oh my goodness.
But yeah, so I'm aware of them and I like them, but I've never like dived deep. There's a lot of it that I don't know.
Okay. And probably you don't want to because you're trying to do something that's original, and if you knew too much of those stories, it might be harder to come up with your
Sometimes,
own.
yeah, sometimes that could be the case, you know, but I don't know. Greek definitely has its own flavor for sure.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I think Apollo was Greek, right? The Greek god of the sun was Apollo.
yeah,
Yeah.
he's like, because Helios is technically the sun god, right? But then you
Oh,
have
okay.
Apollo, but Apollo's also associated with the sun, and I don't know the differentiation because Apollo's also like a god of music.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
I don't know if Apollo's Roman or not. I
Okay.
know they're both fun, but like I told you, I couldn't tell you exactly what it was.
So when you're writing these books that are set in some, you know, in fantasy, and you're having to create a whole world and all the rules in the world, and so does that come, what comes first, that or the actual or the characters or the plot, or is it all a mishmash?
Nine times out of 10, the magic system comes first.
Okay.
So I usually come up with magic or some element of the magic that I want to have. For Star Mother, what's really funny, the first thing thought I had for it was the beginning lines of the novel, which were something along the lines of, I thought that making love to the sun would be the most painful thing I'd ever experienced, but giving birth to his child was far worse. For some reason, those lines just came into my head.
Whoa.
And so I was like, okay, now I have to make a world where this exists. Like, who is this woman? Why is she having the sun's baby? Like, and so, because the godhood, you could call a magic system, right? So,
Right. Yeah.
but yeah, nine times out of 10, I would say I start with a magic system, a magic of some sort.
Okay. And then from that, a character comes to you.
Yeah, often it's characters next.
Yeah.
I mean, generally speaking, I feel like you make your world, and the way your world is will make your characters, and the way your characters are is what makes your plot. But you can definitely bounce around because there's a character I want to be a certain way for a certain book, then I know I need to make the world fit that character. So yeah, it's a little different with each book, I would say.
Okay. And you're doing two a year. To me, that seems like really hard. That you're creating these whole worlds and
You know what?
over and
It's
over
easier than
again.
historicals. Because
Really?
then it's like, well, what's this? I can just make it up off the top of my head. Whereas if it's historical, I have to go research it. And there's some things about history that are really hard to find. When I was writing Veins of Gold, which is a Utah historical, it took me forever to figure out how the mail would work in Utah territory in like 1853. You know, whereas it's a fantasy, I can just make it up. So I honestly think it's easier than doing a historical novel.
Now, do you ever get to like you've have this magic system and you've got your characters and you've got a plot, but you're as you get to a certain point in the story, there's something that doesn't work the way you need it to work.
Well, all the time. So the thing is, like, I will never start writing a story until I have everything working. I'm an outliner. So
Okay.
yeah, so I start with a notebook or on my Remarkable, and they also should be paying me, my Remarkable paper tablet. I will just write down all the ideas I have and just like more and more ideas. Sometimes they're scene ideas, sometimes it's magic ideas. And then once like a story is forming, then I go and I storyboard it with post-it notes on my wall. And then once that's all done, I type up an outline and then I'll write my book. And that's not to say I haven't started writing a book and then realized there's a big flaw and I have to go back and fix it.
But
But it does
not too
help a lot.
much. Yeah. So you start with notes, you storyboard it, you outline it, and then you write it.
Yes.
So this is very organized.
Thank you.
And it sounds like you actually maybe treat writing as a job.
Well, it is my
I
job.
know. That's what I was getting at, So this is your full-time occupation. Yeah. And how did you do the first book? How?
The first book was actually the first time I ever storyboarded anything. So I'm sure you've heard of this, Save the Cat by Blake Snyder. It's a screenwriting book. Somebody wrote a version of it for novelists, but I have not read it yet. But Save the Cat was a screenwriting book. It was all about plotting and storyboarding. And I read it and I thought, I want to try doing a story this way. And I did. And I ended up that being, that was the first one I ended up selling. So it worked.
So, did you the first book you sold, was that the first book you wrote, or
No, it was the
no?
ninth one I'd finished.
The ninth one you finished.
Yes, that was the Paper Magician.
What kept you going through eight that you didn't sell?
Yeah, well, one of them I did eventually, but
Oh.
it's kind of a twofold thing. But the first is just I really just love writing. And even if I wasn't making money on it, I would still be doing it. Maybe not as gung-ho as I do now, but I would still be doing it because I just love storytelling. And the other one is, I don't know, I always was like, the American dream is real, anyone can do it, you know? All those like reality shows in the back of my head. I always just felt like if I keep trying, I'm going to make it. Like, because that's how America works. I don't know. Like, and so I always was just like, yeah, And I have to get all these rejections because all the best authors have hundreds of rejection letters. So I'm just earning my stack. And so it just kept me going.
Were you learning your craft as you went through
definitely.
This?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I kind of joke that one of the reasons it took me so many books to get published is because I just had to learn how to get better the first time, because I'll do about 2 rounds of revisions on a book and then I just burn out on it and I can't anymore. So if it still needs to be fixed, I just throw it in the dumpster and I write something else. And so I always think, well, maybe I just had to learn how to start drafting better. And by the time I get to my 9th one, I was drafting better.
Okay. So you don't do a lot of rewrites then?
No. Well, I do. I usually do 2 by the time I send it to my agent. And then she has a round of copy edits that I do. And then we have to do another round with my dev editor. And then, like, we do copy edits and proofreads and stuff. So really big ones. I do one really big one and one small one. And then my publisher does a really big one.
Okay.
Too.
Okay.
And then there's lots of little ones.
Okay. So you're not saying that rewriting isn't important, because obviously
no, rewriting is very important. One of the benefits I think of having an outline is because if there's big issues, you see it in the outline before you start your book. And I actually recently started having my critique partners read my outline for me, so if there is something big, I want to see it before I put all this work in.
Yeah.
So that's actually helping too.
And of course, you know, there are other people who do it exactly the opposite.
Yeah. I don't like people who just, like, I know people who they can't write a book if they know how it ends, right? And I can't just sit down and like pull something out of my butt. I just like, cuz I know I'm going to have to go back and fix stuff, and I only have so much bandwidth for fixing stuff. You know, I have much more bandwidth for planning.
Interesting. So, yeah, you like the planning process.
I do.
And why don't you read a little bit from Star Mother for us, Charlie?
Okay.
All right.
You're going to find out why I don't read my own audiobooks in just a moment.
Well, most authors don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get that asked that a lot. People are like, oh, do you read your own audiobooks? And I'm like, I have a speech impediment. Why would I do that?
Oh.
No, and I'm like bad. I can't do accents to save my life. And I'm bad at voices. So I would never read my own audiobooks.
Well, to be honest, when I've listened to a lot of audiobooks, and sometimes I think the accents, they shouldn't be doing them. They shouldn't be trying to sound, it's a male reader. Don't try and sound like a woman. It's just,
well, there was one, I won't name it, but there was a book that I started listening to the audiobook. I didn't even get through chapter 1 because the accent was so heavy, I could barely understand what was being said.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, like, why was this okay? Like, who checked off?
Yeah, really?
You know?
Yeah. Okay, so Charlie Holmberg, Star Mother.
All right, here we go. I'm going to do one I haven't done anywhere else before. So I'm going to read from chapter 5. So to set the background, Ceres has already offered to become a star mother. She's been taken to the sun's palace, which is this weird palace that's not a palace. It's hard to describe. And she's already pregnant. So I was practicing my calligraphy months later when Elta came into my room, wringing her small hands. He will see you tonight, Ceres. In this place, one never needed to ask who he was. Has it been 20 weeks already? I asked, my fingers naturally grazing the bump in my abdomen. The time had passed so slowly up to that point, and yet in that moment, looking back on it, I could not see where it had all gone. The life inside me pulsed hot, as though eager to meet its father. Elta rushed to the knot wall and moved her hands around in a complicated pattern until she pulled a crystalline cape free from seemingly nothing. It trailed along the floors like the skirt of a wedding dress, and a pang of sorrow erupted in my chest as I thought of the one I had made by hand only to leave it behind. Had my sister made a match? Would she wear it now? Knowing her, she'd want one of her own. Perhaps my mother would sell it. You'll have dinner with him right after Western set. Elta laid the cape at the foot of the bed. It was always set and rise here, tagged with the relevant hemisphere of the Earth Mother, though I had suspicion such time markers were used only for my benefit, as the side of the Earth Mother didn't matter to those not living on her face. I'll plait your hair and get you some shoes. I looked down at my feet, which hadn't been shod since I removed my shoes on the scorching temple floor. Why dress me up? I lifted my hands. My nails were thin gemstones. Because you are meeting with our Lord. Alta's tone was incredulous. I was not prepared like this when I met him the first time. She paused and glanced at me, blinking large eyes. That was different. I did not see how, but Alta was growing nervous, so I dropped the matter. Were I meeting with a mortal lord, I would be bathed and oiled, my hair carefully coiffed, my eyes lined with kohl, and my cheeks peppered red. I'd wear layer after layer of the finest clothes I owned, plus some lace or whatever other niceties we had to spruce them up. We'd massage butter into my hands and file my nails. I'd chew on parsley for my breath, and rehearse every word I might possibly utter. Here, I wore shoes and a long cape pinned to my shoulders. Alta braided my hair and saw to it that I was comfortable, and that was all. Odd that I would put in so much less effort for a god than for a man. But as I learned in a thousand different ways, the laws of the heavens were quite different than those of men. When the sun doesn't shine on Helkinar, I said, trying to stave off nerves as I awaited my appointment, he shines on the other side of the world. Alta nodded. Then how is he ever here? She smiled at me like I was a child. Compared to her, I suppose I was. Sato is a god, she explained, using a name common among the palace godlings. His ways cannot always be comprehended by mortals. She put up both hands, not to insult your intelligence, but he can split himself in a sense. She paused, likely trying to simplify the explanation. He can leave his brightness in the sky if matters must be addressed elsewhere. He is fully cognizant in both forms, but he is not his whole self. It does make him more susceptible to harm. I sat straighter. Harm? Alta clicked her tongue. Do you think mortals are the only ones who suffer war? I mulled this over, imagining what battle among gods must be like. Alta tidied the room and let me be. It didn't take long for my nerves to catch up with me. I was about to sit down to dinner with the most powerful being I knew, a being I had slept with yet felt no intimacy with, but he was the father of my child. I brushed thoughts of Cain away and walked to the knot door. The palace knew my purpose, and so it did not open to the usual long, contorted hallway, but to a large room seemingly without enclosure. A crystalline table about 6 feet long lay ahead of me, covered in serving platters. A godling set down the last tray of food, and I noticed it was all mortal. Roasted pheasant, an animal I didn't recognize, with stuffed apples and spices, pies and cakes, creamy soup, two different kinds of bread already sliced, a myriad of jams and spreads. It all had the same crystalline sheen as my skin. My stomach rumbled, and the godling glided away as though made of cloud. There were two chairs, one on each end of the table, and I sat down, gazing at the food. It smelled wonderful. My own wedding feast would not have been as grand. The sun did not keep me waiting, so thankfully my thoughts didn't linger on the life I had left behind. He appeared utterly radiant and beautiful, his power as constrained as a god's power could be. He again had taken the form of a man, but something about him, so regal and fierce, still reminded me of a lion on fire that didn't burn, and I wondered how utterly lucent he would be if he had not diminished himself to meet with me. For surely he was divided, as Alta had explained, else somewhere in this world millions of people were missing their day. I thought of his touch against my skin and shivered. He didn't mean to hurt you, I reminded myself, but my body remembered the agony regardless. The sun took a seat at the other end of the table. Saris, he nodded to me. I nodded back. Once he reached for a piece of bread, I began to help myself. Whatever I wanted suddenly became within my reach, and soon my plate was full of food. My stomach was tight with trepidation, but both my star and I were hungry, so I spooned soup into my mouth. It was warm and light and slid pleasantly down my throat. We ate in silence for a long while, long enough for me to finish most of my soup and start on the pheasant. Hating the quiet, especially since I so rarely had company, I asked, "Do gods need to eat?" The sun looked up at me, his diamond eyes brilliant and mesmerizing. "Need, no, but we enjoy the same pleasures as mortals. I do, at least." I nodded. He considered me a moment. "I hear you've depicted me in bundles of yarn." Again, my new form kept me from flushing, but I felt the heat of the statement. "Not yarn, your majesty, threads, an embroidery, a story for the eyes, for my star, our star, so that she, or he, might one day look down at it and know me, in a way." The sun nodded, his eyes cast down to the meal before him. "I see." Silence floated between us. I took a few bites of honey cake before speaking again. "What were they like, the star mothers before me?" He did not look up from his plate. "There were many before you, Saris, the same number as the stars." I looked up at the night sky, taking in the expanse of stars. The moon was never there. I hadn't seen the moon in 5 months. The last few, then, I pressed. What were they like? The sun set down his utensil and folded his fiery hands beneath his chin. Must you ask? Must I not? I countered. He pressed his lips together for a few heartbeats before speaking. I would do a poor job of answering. I could tell you their names, but I know very little about them. A new ping echoed in my chest. Why? He met my eyes fully. I do not revel in their deaths. Mortal life is so fleeting, but it is still life. It is still gone when a star is born. I studied his face, which seemed to become more human the longer I looked. My shoulders slumped. Why must the stars be born? Why must their numbers always be the same? He investigated me like I was a book in a foreign language. Even from across the table, he seemed very close, like he could simply reach out and turn one of my pages. Stars were one of the first things the universe created. They are the source of its power and mine. Starlight is the reason the world spins and moves through the heavens, the reasons the tides rise and fall, the reason rain falls and fire burns. Without stars, the rest of it ceases to exist. I had never considered this, and my food went untouched for a full minute while my mind tried to grasp his meaning. Does not the Earth Mother turn herself, or Tareth move the tides? You asked me if gods eat. No, not in the way mortals do. He lowered his hands to the table. But we, too, survive on starlight. The Earth Mother would not turn without the stars. The sun would not burn. Even those who devoured darkness would be unable to do so without the stars. A heavy breath escaped me. I see. When even one star dies, there is suffering. Thus it has been given to me and mortals to keep the stars burning. If the universe made them, I chose each word carefully, then why not make them immortal as well? His lip ticked, like what I said, what is amusing. If it had the ability to create an endless source of power, it would have done so. Stars are the most noble of godlings. They burn brilliantly and nourish everything around them. But everything we are given comes at a cost. In order for stars to give of themselves, they must be able to die. That is why they must be born of a mortal. My mind traced back to our earlier topic. How many star mothers before me? Any mirth the sun felt dissipated. I cleared my throat and took my questions another direction. How often does a star die? The god looked away from me, taking another piece of bread that he didn't eat onto his plate. It depends. 50 years might go by, or 200. The universe is not cruel. I took another sip of soup and washed it down with 2 sweet wine. Once my palate was clear, I said, the star mothers are mortals, but their passing hurts you. That's why you don't get close to them. The sun did not answer. I picked up my food, but didn't raise any of it to my mouth. May I speak freely, your majesty? His lip quirked. You have not asked for permission before now. Then I have it. He nodded. I think that is selfish. His reaction was subtle, the slight lifting of his head, the tightening of the corners of his eyes. Is it? It was more a statement than a question. We give our lives for the stars, for you. I measured each word carefully. Our lives are fleeting, yes, but they are worthy. Is it so much to ask to be remembered? My throat closed and I swallowed to force it open. A gift of remembrance from the greatest being in the universe. I am not the greatest, he whispered. To us, you are, I pressed. When you dine with a future star mother and she asks, tell me about the others. I want you to say my name and where I came from. I want you to tell her about me. He studied me for a breath before asking, and what would I tell her? I placed my fork beside my plate and folded my hands in my lap, reflecting on that. You should tell her that I spoke out of turn often, and I made poor replicas of your face and string, but that I was kind to your servants and spoke my mind. You should tell them what you think of me, your highness. You should speak of me fondly, as the bringer of a star, as the mother of your child. He considered this a long moment, dropped his gaze. You are right, of course. I'm not stupid, I added. I know you are the sun. I know you have great responsibility and great power and do not have the time to learn every intricacy of who I am, but neither should you shy away from me because my death makes you sad. I guess we could probably stop there.
And that was Charlie N. Holmberg reading from Star Mother. So, Saris, is she based on anyone you know?
Nope. You know what's really funny is whenever I write a fantasy novel, they're always just completely made up. But whenever I write a contemporary, which I've started doing recently, they're always like based on somebody. I feel like, I don't know. Once I'm in the real world, then I start making those connections. But when I'm in fantasy land, I don't at all.
Well, how much of yourself is she?
I mean, there's a little bit of me in all of my characters, right? But if they were
Right.
all a lot like me, then all my books would be the same.
Well, that's true.
So
That's
I
true.
did try, one of the things I did, what's really funny is I tend to default to these introverted, quiet, but silently strong like protagonists, which is really funny because I am an extrovert. And so I realized that, and I was talking to my friend Caitlin, who I do my podcast with, about it too. And I was like, I need to write more extroverts. And so Ceres is one of my few extroverted characters. The thing is, she's not in a lot of big groups of people very often. So hopefully it comes across, but she doesn't get a ton of opportunity.
Well, that's true, but she's definitely what would you say, assertive.
Assertive, yes, she
Yes.
definitely is.
Yes. Yeah. That kind of came through not just in this scene, but throughout. She's not passive. She's kind
No.
of, yeah. So I just, had a feeling that you might be that
Yeah,
the same.
I share some of them. So.
Now, in your acknowledgments in Star Mother, it starts out with kind of an interesting comment. You say it's ironic that this book revolves so much around light because it helped pull me out of a dark place. I'd gotten into the habit of running before walking, of stretching too thin, and it broke for me a bit in 2019.
Yeah.
So, you want to tell us anything about that, or?
So it was so interesting because people are always like, oh, 2020 was so bad, right? And I'm like, no, actually, 2019 was my hard year. Yeah, it was just super interesting. So I am, there's a creatives tend to, how do I word this? Creative people, I feel like, are more likely to have mental hardships than other people. Like, we're more likely to have anxiety or to have depression or something like that. And I am very fortunate in that I don't have any like clinical anything. But it was so weird because I'm still not totally sure what it was that like caused it. But like in 2019, I just had like, just even from the beginning of the year, I had a really hard time finishing books. I wrote this one novel which I really loved, and I just couldn't finish it. And so I went to another one, which was Spellmaker. And I wrote like 60,000 words and I just couldn't finish it. And then all of a sudden I just got depressed for the first time in my life. Like that kind of like sad, like you're just sad for no reason, you know? And I was like, I have so much more like respect and like empathy with people who do suffer with depression regularly, 'cause I'm like, this would suck if this was all the time. And I had it for a little while and it was hard, and it was so bad, and I had to stop writing for like the first time in my life. And I was trying to, it was like October, and I was just going on all these walks and trying to like figure out like what to do, because it's hard to know what to do when you can't figure out what's broken, you know? And so I'm a religious person, so I turned a lot to prayer, and I just had to step away from like my writing. And like writing is something, like again, I said I would do even if I didn't get paid for it. It just brings me a lot of joy, and I just couldn't do it for the first time ever. And even though I had all these unfinished books, one of which was under contract, so Star Mother was an idea I had, and I'd written the first like five chapters of it and then put it aside. And for some reason, I just started thinking about that book again and got some different ideas for it. And I just let myself very like I was treating myself like a glass doll, because I'm like, I don't want to break anything else, because I had a feeling it was tied to my writing somehow. And I just let myself like start rereading it and like tweaking it and changing it, and suddenly that book sparked in me, and it like, I don't know, it's hard to explain, like it just pulled me out of it, and I wrote that book instead of the other ones, and like it went away. Like I got out of it, which was such a relief, and I was able to write this book. And the funny thing is, it's like I haven't fallen back into that since. But even when I was recovered, I had such a hard time finishing those other two books, even though I liked those books. It was like I had a weird mental block from that experience. So I had to really, like I said, one of them was under contract. I had to finish it. So it was hard, but yeah, I don't know what it was. Something about Star Mother just helped me just climb out of that darkness. So
Well, I know what I can understand what you're saying because I have been around a lot of people in my life with depression, and I am fortunate that I don't have issues with that. But I had two experiences where I felt it for brief times, and it did help give me more empathy for people who suffer with it. One was many years ago, and it was very, very short, and it was kind of situational. But then in 2016, I, for the first time in many years, had actually got the flu. And when I was recovering from the flu, I felt depressed. And I realized, or I did a little research, and that is actually a side effect of the flu, is depression. So I'm wondering if that might have been a trigger for you
Interesting.
too.
No, I wasn't
No,
sick.
no. Okay.
I think I've had the flu. I'm gonna knock on wood here. I've had the flu once in my life.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I know,
So.
and you hear about it. It's like you hear about the flu, and if you've never had it, you don't realize how debilitating it is for the brief time. Like you barely
Well,
get out
did
of
see
bed.
did I wonder did
And
I have the flu? Because I had a like this is like 10 years ago. I had a cold and I threw up, and so I figured it was flu and that
oh
was
no. The flu is you can't get out of bed. You
Yeah.
cannot
See,
get out of bed.
I've never been that
Yeah,
sick.
I've only had it once, and so that's, boy, the mind is a weird thing, isn't
It is. It
it?
is. Like, I almost feel like it'd be easier to have like a physical thing than to have something like depression or like clinical anxiety. Now my cat is here. He's trying to
Ah.
walk in front of me. Come here. Meowing. There he is. Meowing.
Oh, that is a big cat.
He's just big because he's close to the camera. He's actually pretty
Oh,
small. He doesn't have
okay.
a tail.
Oh,
So.
so you must be an animal lover.
Yeah, I do. I do like animals. We got our dog like 5 years ago, and I was raised very much so to hate cats. My mom hates shush. My mom hates cats. I was raised to believe the only thing cats are good for is target practice. But
Oh, no.
yeah, at the beginning of the year, he's gonna be meowing. I'm so sorry. At the beginning of the year, we read us my husband and I read this study, and it was a small study, but about how cats can help autistic children because my daughter is autistic. And so I was like, oh my gosh, do we have to get a cat? And I never thought I'd ever be a cat owner. And we started just looking into it and on and off and on and off. And it's actually kind of a funny story how we got him. It was like divinely inspired, but we ended up fostering him from a local shelter and keeping him. And I adore this cat. I don't know if I'm a cat person. I'm definitely a Diego person. I love him so much, though. And so I'm glad we did it.
I had two friends in the past 2 years who were never cat people and had a cat kind of wander into their lives, and now that they just adore. They just
Yeah.
adore these cats. So it must be a thing that's going around.
We're all secretly cats.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Charlie N. Holmberg, author of Star Mother. Now, do you write other forms other than novels? Do you do any short story writing, essay, memoir?
I have a couple of short stories. I don't like do it on purpose. I usually like there was a couple I had to write for Deep Magic eZine, which unfortunately closed this year, but I was on the board for Deep Magic eZine, which did clean speculative fiction, short fiction. And so sometimes I would get roped into that. Like we would let our readers pick these random props and we'd have to write a story for them. Like I had to write one about flaming bagpipes. Which I turned it into a horror novel. There was one other one. Oh, and then I had to write one about it was like an army of chocolate has to fight an army of ice cream at the tower at the pyramids of Giza during World War II. And I was like, are you serious? This is your writing prompt? But I think I did a pretty good job with it. I had it be it was a kid in class learning about the pyramids of Giza, and he was eating a candy bar. And it fell on his paper, and he like pretended like they were soldiers. So that's how I ended up doing it. But Yeah, and then I wrote one for BYU. BYU had this like pandemic thing where they wanted short fiction for about pandemics in some way during 2020. So I wrote one for them too, and they're all on my website. So if anybody listening wants to check them out, my website is charlienholmberg.com. They're all on there for freezies.
Awesome.
But yeah, I'm doing a novella next year, but otherwise, yeah, novels are my jam.
So why a novella?
It's because it's going into an anthology that is a charity anthology to raise money for a horse rescue in California. So it'll be my first historical that doesn't have magic in it.
Oh.
Yeah.
So how do you do historical with magic?
Easy. Put magic in it. No, like you just get, and people who read me can see that I get slightly better at historicals as I go along, because I never intended to be a historical author, but my debut series was originally Otherworld. It was high fantasy, but I had been watching Downton Abbey at the time, so it felt kind of English, and my editor wanted me to make it English. And okay. So we ended up making it Edwardian, and it's not totally historically accurate, but I get better at it. But because like that did so well, so now I do historicals and I do high fantasy. But what was the question? I don't even remember.
But something about historicals and magic, but putting historicals and magic, or I mean, if you put magic in it, it's not exactly historical anymore.
Yeah,
but
alternate history.
Yeah, alternate history.
And it's just fun to think, like, what would Jane Austen be like if she could, you know, turn wood into metal?
And there was a series on this that aired this past year that was so, it was very Edwardian, and it was exactly that. And I wish I could remember what it was. I watched it, but it's definitely what you're talking about. You must be familiar with Orson Scott Card.
Yes, I've read Ender's Game, and I've read his How to Write Science Fiction and Fantasy Novel.
Okay, so he did a whole nother series that was an alternative history, the Seventh Son series, and that, Ender's Game, of course, is a classic, but those are very, I found them really, really interesting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's the Alvin Maker series, actually, is what it was called.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was very cool. And I think he's a Utah person.
He does not live in Utah. He is a Latter-day Saint, so I can see why you would think he
is. Yeah.
I think he lives on the East Coast.
Okay.
But I'm not positive.
Okay. And you mentioned that you're a religious person. Does your religion get into your writing in any way? Do you?
You know, not on purpose, but I'm sure it does. But which is actually kind of funny, because I've seen some bad reviews before that would be like, oh, she's preaching to us, but like the religious aspect in the book in question is not what I believe. It's what the characters believe, right? Because like my characters will believe different things than I do. But for example, so I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and like we have a really big thing about genealogy, for example, and there's a lot of genealogy in Star Mother and in my next series that's coming out too. So it's like I know all about genealogy because of my religious beliefs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then the whole idea of like creationism and stuff was definitely in Magic Bitter, Magic Sweet. But then like there's also this element in Magic Bitter, Magic Sweet where these, I don't want to spoil anything, but they're kind of like the godlings in Star Mother, but they're genderless and they can choose their gender, right? And that's not necessarily aligning with my religion, you know. But you know, that sounds kind of weird. Like, let's just put out there, like, I love LGBT people, you know. But like, so there's definitely elements in my books that are religious but aren't my religion.
Okay.
You know?
Right.
But I think there's little things that definitely end up in there.
Okay. Now, have any of your books been made into movies?
Almost. So Disney did have the rights to the initial Paper Magician trilogy, but because COVID shut down all the parks and ruined everything, they did not renew this year. So as of right now, we don't have any movie rights, which is too bad. I was really excited about it. I had gotten to see a script and stuff, but yeah.
It got that far.
Yeah, but it's dead in the water now. So if you know any movie producers, send them my way.
Yeah, that's That would be exciting, wouldn't it? Because writing a book is a very solitary thing, right? Mm-hmm. Although it sounds like you have a critique group, and you know,
yeah,
maybe you aren't. We could talk about that a little more, but then when it goes to a movie, it becomes such a collaborative exercise.
I feel like if anything I ever made was like a movie, I'd probably just have a hernia and die. Like, I feel like it'd be so weird to like see this person I made up in my head moving on the screen. Like, that'd be so weird, but awesome. It'd be so awesome.
It would be awesome. It would be. So let's talk about your writer's group. How long have you been involved, and how does it work?
So I wouldn't even call it a writer's group anymore. When I was first starting out, I had like official writer's groups, and we would meet every like week or two and read our stuff. But now it's mostly just critique partners. So once I write my first draft, which I don't even spell check it, I just finish it and I send it to my alpha readers, and they're usually other writers. So I'm going to name drop. Trisha Levenseller is one of them. But I send it to other writers, and they will read it, and they tell me all the big problems with it. And then I go and I revise it. And then I take that one and I send it to my beta readers, who are not writers, just readers. And so they'll catch the typos for me, or like, this thing's weird. Or one of my beta readers is a civil engineer. And so she'll like correct. She's like, it's not cement, it's concrete. like just these weird things that you wouldn't even think about. Or like they'll catch my anachronistic words if I'm doing historicals and stuff like that. And then I send it to my agent. So I have like two groups of critique partners.
And how did you originally get an agent?
Cold querying. I don't have any fun stories. I had never met her before. She had rejected me one other book of mine, and I just sent her the query for Paper Magician, and she read the full and liked it, and we signed up together. So
how many agents had you queried by that point?
Oh, God, I can't even tell. So many.
And how did you decide who to send the queries to?
I would Google it. I would look up agents who represented what I wanted to write. I made sure that they did fantasy, but that they would do young adult and adult, because I wanted to write both. And some agents don't. And so whatever agent would fit into those parameters, which there are quite a few, I would send them queries.
And now in this day and age, you know, querying is, back when I was first starting and did some querying years and years ago, you had to mail it.
Yeah.
And wait for to get the rejection letter in the mail. And you were only supposed to send one at a time. I'm assuming that's much, much different now that it's...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's all email. I one that I did have to mail. Yeah, somebody wasn't up with the times. But, yeah, it's all done through email now, or some of them have submission forms just on their website that you do. And that's, like, the big thing. You always have to read. Each agent wants something a little different, so you always have to read all their submission guidelines and make sure you're sending them what they want.
So,
I remember one time I had an agent send back something like, please follow our submission guidelines and resubmit. And I was like, I did. I went through all of them. Like, I followed everything. I don't know what your problem is.
Oh, so some people want just sample chapters, someone outlines.
Yeah, some people want just the query. Some people want a partial. Yeah, it's all very different.
Yeah. And so now, are you most usually writing under contract? You have a contract for a book before you write it?
No, I usually write the book and then I get a contract. That's writing on proposal, right? So where you have an idea, you sell it, and then you write the book. I'm kind of afraid to do that, because it's like, what if there's been a few books where I start writing them and I'm like, I don't like this, and I just chuck it. And I'm like, what if that happened and I had it under contract? I would have to finish it, and then it would make me hate writing.
Sounds like you often have more than one book going at a time.
I often will be like, I'll be like drafting one book and maybe writing down brainstorming ideas for another, you know, but only once have I actually drafted two books at the same time. And that was Plastic Magician and Will in the Wild, because Plastic Magician was under contract. And then I had this weird phallic dream about that ended up being found with the Will in the Wild. And I wanted to write it so badly, but I was like, okay, you have to do your word count for Plastic Magician before you can write this book. And so I ended up at the same time. time. That's the fastest I've ever written. I wrote 2 novels in 6 weeks.
Whoa. Well, how many books have you started and set aside?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. Probably at least 15.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
And how far do you get in before you realize this isn't going to work?
You know, there was one I wanted to write about krakens, like sea monsters, and I only got 2 chapters in because trying to figure out all of the, because I'm writing about sailors and they need to know how all the things on the boat work. And I was just like, I hate researching boat stuff. So I gave up on that one. But then there was a magical regency one that I got like 60,000 words into. And I was just like, I just don't feel this book anymore. I don't think it's good. And I just stopped working on it.
Oh, wow. Do you ever think you might go back to that?
Nah.
No.
there's one book that I actually did finish that's way too short that I still like the magic system of. Actually, there's 2 books like that that maybe I'll go back someday. But most of the time, it's like if I lose interest, the interest is just gone. Definitely. So.
Now, do you have any advice for people wanting to write fantasy?
Yeah, listen to my podcast.
Oh, well, tell us about your podcast.
Here's my advice.
Yeah, what is your podcast?
No, I have a podcast I do with Caitlin McFarland called Your Mom Writes Books.
Aw.
Yeah. And so we do all kinds of, like, writing advice on there. So that way I can shamelessly plug myself at the same time. And we talk about, like, what our advice would be and, like, our journeys and stuff. But, I mean, it's pretty basic. Do a daily word count. I wasn't able to finish books until I held myself to a daily word count. And just let yourself suck. Like, a lot of people don't finish books because they're so worried it's so bad, or they go back and keep re-revising the same few pages. And it's like, just let it suck. Just let it be bad. Just write it. You know, it's okay.
So what is your daily word count?
I don't do a daily word count anymore. I just do it now, okay. Right? But I remember when I was in college, if I was in school, I would only have to do 500 words a day. Okay. And if I was out of school, I had to do 1,000 words a day.
And was that 5 days a week, 7 days a week?
It was usually 5, yeah.
5 days a week.
Yeah. Wow.
And now you mentioned that you always have things completely outlined before you start writing. So these books that you set aside, you had gone through that entire process of outlining?
Yeah. And I mean, whenever I'm writing, there's always things that are going to come up that aren't in the outline, because the outline's the major things.
Right.
You know, so there's always some surprise or a little bit of pantsing when you're going. But yeah, with all the ones that I killed, I usually had an outline all made out for it. And I was just like, meh. I don't feel that sad about it because, like, I literally no longer care about this book. So,
well, you've definitely learned the lesson of not caring about sunk costs.
About what?
Sunk costs. It's a business theory, you know, that mm-hmm. a lot of times we make decisions based on sunk costs, that we say, oh, we already have so much invested in this, we have to go forward with it. Mm-hmm. Even though if you were looking at it like without that investment, you'd like, no, this isn't any good. And
yeah.
So you basically have that one down.
Yeah.
you do not get bogged down by sunk costs.
No.
That's great. Now, is there some type of writing you haven't done that you would like to do?
You know, I mean, this is genre specific. I think that horror writers are like the bee's knees, which is funny. I don't read horror, right? I don't read it. But I just feel like when someone says, I'm a horror writer, like they're the cool kids on the block. I mean, I got to read it if I'm going to write it, but I always thought it'd be so cool to write a horror novel.
Well,
so I just feel like that's the cool thing to do.
You know, the first real horror novel writer was a woman.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Was that Mary Shelley?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she invented the whole genre, really.
Go you.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fun to write skits, you know, like comedy skits.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But.
Well, tell me a little bit about your songwriting.
Oh, there you go. I actually, that's almost what I majored in college was music composition. But I knew that if I had to sit in class for 4 years and learn about music theory, that I would end up hating it. So I didn't do that. But I wrote music a ton as a teenager and all through college too. I would always have like somebody else sing it, or I would do like an arrangement or something, or just like a piano piece. And then I don't know what it was. I got married right after I graduated college and I just stopped writing music. I just stopped playing the piano. I guess I just took all my music time and put it towards my husband. But yeah, a few years ago, I was just dinking around on the piano and I decided I wanted to write a piano piece for The Will in the Wild. And it's a really simple piece, but it was like the first song I had written in years. And I thought it was really cool. And I found a producer who would like record it for me. And I found out that he did like producing and composition and stuff like that. So I kind of signed on with him, and I write mostly pop songs, pop rock and alternative. So I just like, they're not going anywhere. The music business is crazy hard to break into. I'm not an artist. I have no desire. I'm not a singer. No desire to perform in front of people. I just want to write the songs. But it's really hard to get in. Like, you really do have to move to LA or into Nashville to get into it. So it's like, you know, I just be like a little indie creator, and I have them up on Spotify and on my YouTube channel. So I'm like, I'm content with this for now. You know, like, I'm never going to make my money back. But
and you wrote a song for Ceres.
I did. I wrote a song for Star Mother. It's called Song of Ceres. So one of the things they say, it's like, oh, like one of the reasons you sacrifice to be a Star Mother is like your name is, you're honored. Your name is honored. Your family is honored. All this stuff. And they say your name will be remembered in song. And when Ceres comes back, it's 700 years later, but there's still a song that people sing in her village to remember her. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I turned it into a real song?
Well, why don't we listen to the Song of Ceres?
My producer's wife singing it.
That is great. Well, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us, Charlie. You're just a joy to talk to. The Star Mother was really fun to read.
Thank you.
It's something that I would pick up and read for fun.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you all, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.